wasn't sure how I was going to do this because there's a new chapter to my story. But like the old ones told me a long time ago, keep it real simple. What it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So what it was like was I come up in these Texases in the 70s where you smoke pot, drink Schwitz beer, and listen to ZZ Top. Right passes, It's just the way things were. My drinking wasn't real exciting. You come to out of a blackout in the parking lot of a far bar in Delta Junction, Alaska, being strangled by someone named Bonsai Bob. You might have to draw him alcohol. I was a blackout drunk from day one, and I didn't drink like my friends, I drank and I thought I'd passed out, Oh no. You come to in the morning, your head hurts, and you walk in the living room, and everybody stops talking. And then, liberally, someone asks you that question that you weren't aware in fear of. Do you know what you did last night? It was never anything cool. It was always something horribly embarrassing, So that's what my drinking was like. In a vision for you, it talks about it. It says, the more we withdrew from society, we became denizens of King Alcohol. We sought out sordid places, hoping to find companionship. Momentarily, we did. Then would come to the hideous four horsemen. First time I read that was sometime in 1984 after my boss fired me for running my crew off the roof with the hatchet because he pissed me off. And I lived with my boss. And when he fired me, I did what we do. I went out, got drunk, came home, and there was this pamphlet on my pillow. Now, they never gave me more than 30 minutes off to lunch because they had to retrain me. But this pamphlet contained 12 questions. And each point burned themselves into my consciousness. And forever after, I would set them off when I drank. They were the 12 questions of AA. So that morning I go out and he's at the table and he's reading the paper and I'm trying to do anything but make eye contact, and he had this book open and it opened to A Vision for You. And I read that and I realized what I was reading and I wept real quick. Years later, I got to sit in his room. I'd be dying. I had a little over a year sober, and he'd been in a coma for a while. And I was sitting there, and they were doing a hot pack on the roof. And he clears his throat, and he said, "Eric, remember that time I had to fire you?" "Yes, sir." I said, "That was a hard thing for me to do. So I'm glad to see your mate. Not make it, make it." That is why I told him I spoke to him. So, my drinking, like you can imagine, drink blackout, screw up, embarrass yourself, and you got to get out of town. I've ran from Galveston, Texas, all the way to Fairbanks, Alaska. Always the same things. Seen some beautiful countries, some of them I actually remember. So that's how my drinking was. But there's one thing that was steadfast and constant in my life. A guy named Mike Carr. She was my best friend from the age set. When I'm 7 years old, my mother passed away, the whole world crashed. He was there. We ran everywhere together. We had dreams. You know, from the time that we were 12 years old, we found brother's stash pop in his stack of Easy Rider magazines. We knew what we were going to do, right? We were going to get Harleys, and we were getting out of Texas. We never met that world kid. He got married and had a kid, quit smoking a drink. Ruined our plan. February 1986, I come in off the road. I'd been on the road for about 5-6 years. I was drunk out. I came home to die. I was at his mom and dad's house, and he showed up. And he brought me a message of recovery. He told me that he had gotten clean sober through a 12-step program. And I asked him the ever-important question. How much does it cost? He said, it doesn't cost anything. I said, well, I want to go. Never forget this because it's probably the first time I uttered any truth in my life. He said, man, you don't have to do that for me. I said, no, I got to do it for me. I know where that came from, but it was true. So he took me to this place called Tadass. It was in a church, which, you know, it's already going wrong. Me and God had an agreement, you know. He stayed out of bars, I stayed out of churches. I'm an atheist. You know. I even joined the Atheist Society. You know, we would meet at a little coffee shop in Hemet, California, and eat sandwiches and pastries and drink coffee and had any philosophical conversation. And they took me aside one day and said, Eric, we don't want you to join us for coffee anymore. Why? Because you're not an atheist. I most certainly am too. They said, no, Eric, you're not. In fact, you're probably more devout than the Pope. How can you not believe in someone you cuss with every breath? Okay, I believe in God. I just believed he was a dirt. Didn't like me much either. Yeah, like I said, we had an agreement. I stayed out of churches, he stayed out of bars. He didn't uphold his end of the bar. Because last few years of my drinking, things were getting real dangerous. And these strange people kept popping up. Riverside, California, I had my bike. I blew a front piston on this Sportster 66. Blew a front piston, had parts in this guy's garage, and I go by work on it, and he got my shotgun. And he sticks in my face, pulls the trigger, and it misfires. So he beats me with it. His wife came out, yelled at him. When he turned his head, I ran like a rabbit. Yeah. Nothing but freeways up there. But through the blood, you know, I'm looking. There's a field, train tracks. I can get to the tracks. I can beat feet. I don't want him following me. I get to the edge of the field, and a car pulls over, and this guy stops as Bob. I turn around, and he says, you're not Bob, but you need a ride. Get in. So we take off and we pull into this Taco Bell and he leaves me in his car with it running. And that's when I know the stuff. He had this fish thingy on the dashboard and book. He was one of them, Christian. He comes back out, hands me a glass of water and paper towels to wipe the blood off my face. And he carried me home. He never mentioned God once. He didn't have to. God was oozing out of every pore. Few weeks later, I'm waiting outside this house to procure some pharmaceutical. And this guy pulls up on one of them newfangled V-twin Kawasaki's, and he gets off, and he's got a pound of coffee under one arm and this big blue book in the other hand. And he looks at me, and he looks right through me. How you do it? Me with my thousand-yard stare going, oh, all right. It's the, huh? So you ever get sick and tired being sick and tired? This is a safe house. You ever need someone to talk to, come here. That scared the bejeebus out of me. I beat feet out of there real quick. So, like I said, my friend brought me to this place. And I walked in, and it's in this church. Walk in, there's like 60 young people jammed in this room, smoking cigarettes, drinking coffee, laughing their asses off. And there was a feeling in there that I cannot describe. I don't have to. Y'all know what it is. It's unconditional love, it's recovery. It's teenage hormones and a hell of a lot of coffee. So me, be quick study I am, I deduce that it must be in the coffee. So I drank about 17 cups that night. All that happened was then sweet for a week and I had to pee a lot. But that was the start. There was a guy there named Mike Dale. Now, I can say his name because he's graduated. He was the director of this program, Tyler Drug Beats program, TDAPT. And he said, you know, you might need a little more than what we offer. And he put me on the bike and he brought me 1034 East Lake Street. And I walked in here. And that was the oddest assortment of people I've ever seen in my entire life. There was old people, young people, rich people, poor people. Some guy said he was a brain surgeon. He was.
What?
And they talked about how I felt. And they talked about how I thought. You see, when I got here, I had a simple, very simple, philosophy. I was an alien. That, or I was an earth person, and y'all were alien. Because I was not like anyone else till I walked in here. There was a lady behind the podium. She stood 6'6" with platinum blonde hair. Her name was Mo. Girl type drunk. She was getting a chip for 28 years in 1986. And she talked about what it was like, what happened. And I wanted what she had. Because there was light in her eyes. And she talked about her feelings, way she saw things. And just for a moment, I could see infinity. She said, you can go as far as you want to go in this program. The only limits were when you put on it. And I believed her. I still do. So I grew up in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got here, I was 22. I was a sparrow. It took me 5 years in recovery before I quit biting people and peeing on furniture. But, AA made sense. Nothing in my life ever made sense. I never knew what was expected of me. I never knew how to respond appropriately. There was no guidebook. It's like, boom, you're born. Here, there you go. There was no role models. My father was now college, so he was World War II vet, been in my age for a year. He had issues. He did a hell of a job, in my opinion. And the day he passed away, the last thing he said to me was, "I love you, son. God, I'm proud of you." AA made that possible. And when he passed away, it was AA that surrounded me and carried me when I could not walk. So I hung out in these rooms and I drank your coffee and ogled your women. I learned some of the lingo. As y'all have definite lingo in here, keep coming back. Easy does that, you know. Let go, let God. Okay. So I hung out in the rooms and I had my sponsor, Mike. You know, and he got me through the first three steps. Yeah. We were going to do my four step when we got back from his camp out. Except he never made back. June 6, 1986, we were tubing down Wallow River and drowned. I was with him. George Carlin used to do a skit about your 2-minute warning, you know? 2 minutes, get your shit together. I was with Mike when he got it. I didn't understand what was going on, and I was scared to death. And he just looked at me and said, "It's okay, old buddy." I've never seen another human being so peaceful in my entire life. 20 minutes later, he went home. Yeah. And I'm thinking, this ain't right. I'm sober. People aren't supposed to weep, man. You know, God, you know, what are you doing? People do weep. Dear friend of mine, Gig Harper Washington, told me that people arrive on time, they depart on time. You know, and that's true. I've been blessed to know some wonderful people in this room here, especially Frank King, Foster, Stanley K. K.D. Miller.
Goddamn, boy.
You keep doing that, you might stay sober. If he taught me how to wash coffee cups and empty ashtrays, put chairs back. Yeah. These were the people that were here when I got here, who were so very patient with me. And they taught me things and taught me what AA is about. So I spent about 18 months throwing out the window, making a lot of meetings, and going stark raving sober. Until I finally reached that point to where I was either going to drink or die. And I finally went up to this guy and I said, "How do you do this? Send the book. There's a lot of shit in that book, man. How do you stay sober?" So he took me by the hand, walking you through the steps. And when we got step three, he said, "All right, Eric, what is your will in your life?" That was when I, how are you going to turn something over? You don't know what it is. He said, "There's your will, your thinking, your life, and your actions. Had your thinking and doing ever got you in trouble?" "You only when I'm conscious." "Okay, a time or two when I wasn't." "So do you think God could do a better job of thinking and doing than you are?" "Well, with the 22, I'm living under bread, yeah." "At this point, a rabid weasel could do a better job." My. So he led me through the steps. and some things kind of cut through the fog and came apparent, you know. That's how you let go of something. You know, I thought you said the third step prayer and ta-da, you're right. No. Yeah. Every time we go from step one to step 12, it changes the way I think, just a little bit. And when I change the way I think, change the way I act. And when I change the way I act, I change the way I feel. And that's why I drank. So when I started doing this, and, you know, I met this woman. Okay, I took hostage. We had a kid. Looks just like me, poor thing. And we moved to Gig Harbor, Washington. I had 5 years sober, and like I said, it still wasn't quite how it was broken at that point. But I was doing better, you know. We were up there, and the first thing I did was check in with AA. And I called Sinful Service, and an intoxicated person answered. There are no me's in Gig Harbor. I thought to myself, oh, crap, what am I going to do? So I called Al-Anon. They gave me the address, offered to come pick me up and take me. Hey, Al-Anon. So I get there, and it's in the basement of a Caldwell Baker building. I know I'm in the right place because there's styrofoam cups and cigarette butts all over the ground. Yep, this is it. And I walked in, there's this old guy sitting there carving on a wooden duck. Got a beard, looked kind of like Grizzly Adams. He says, coffee's right over there. I said, thank you, I'm Eric. And he sat bolt upright in his chair and said, boy, where are you from? I'm from Power, Texas. Yeah, I'm Buddy Adams. I'm from Baton Rouge. Thank God there's someone that talks right. He became my sponsor. He was the crustiest, mean, big book, thumpless old coot I'd ever met, gotten sober in 1974. He was also the most loving, compassionate, caring individual I've ever met. And he continued to meet needs of his staffs. And when my wife left and took my son, it broke my heart. He was there. AA was there. And I stayed up there for another year and a half, and then things just wasn't working out. You know, I hurt my back, had struggled through that, took a job doing whatever I could, and I just wasn't making it. One of the guys I sponsored in Tyler told me to come home. So I need you to come home. I'm getting a chip I need you to give to me. I'll give you a place to live. Just come home. Well, you know, that's always been my M.O. Pack my stuff, run. I want to do that this time. You know, it was my son. Now, are you going to leave my son? So I'm on the sidewalk at this cafe in Gig Harbor with my sponsor, and we're talking. And he said, Eric, you prayed about it, you've written about it, we're talking about it. Maybe it's time to go home. Yeah, I know, but we went in to get another cup of coffee, and I just hung my head and said, God, I need a sign so sinful that not even I can screw it up. This kid walked around the corner wearing a t-shirt that said, wait, it gets better. I've seen this kid in the 2.5 years I've been there, seen him hanging outside with Nate and talking girls, smoking cigarettes. Actually seen him in the meeting once. I said, man, where are you from? He says, oh, you've never heard of this little town. I said, no, man, where are you from? I'm from Tyler, Tech. But wait, there's more. I said, man, that's my home. That's where I got sober. She says, I went through treatment in Seattle, but my grandpa didn't program there. Maybe he knew him. His name's Stockard. Now, some of y'all don't know that name. But you see, when I got here, when Mike brought me here, two men set me on the couch in there. One of them held a cup of coffee for me. The other one rubbed my back. They were Stanley Kay and Stockard. I'm 2,800 miles from Tyler, Texas, and I run into the grandson of the old-timer that detoxed me. I asked God for a sign. He gave me a marquee. That is what my sobriety been like. There was a time when I had 18 months sober before things really started to congeal. Yeah, I'm kind of slow learner. I'm staying with my dad in Magnolia, Arkansas. I decided I was going to drink. My girlfriend had ran up with the guy I sponsored, and I missed him real bad. So I was going to drink. I knew that at 5:30, my dad would walk through that door, set his fifth the Kentucky Deluxe on the table, and go to the bathroom. When he was in the bathroom, I was going to spin the cap and chug as much as I could. 5:30 came and went, he didn't show. 6:30 came, he called me, said he would duck on the rig for the rest of the night. Well, hell, I'll watch TV. Now, in Magnolia, Arkansas, they have three camps. Okay, I'm watching this show, Dragnet. I love Dragnet. A little girl was missing. The mother is hysterical. No account. Ex-husband of mine. I know he took her. Thought. So they show up at his house or his apartment. They knock on the door. This mild-mannered guy answers the door in suit. And they identify themselves. He's alarmed that his child's missing. Then he stops and says, I guess my ex-wife told you some bad things about me. They're true. But we haven't had a drink in 18 months. We? Yes, my higher power and the members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Change of temp. It's my. I love my. Kyogi remind me of my aunt. The one down the bar. They're at a party. Arthur gets drunk, makes fool of himself, and they have a huge argument. He storms out. He's gone all night. Bob is frantic. He comes in the next morning and goes, it's okay, Bob. I went to an AA meeting. Oh dear, I changed the channel. Last chance. It's a street scene card going by and someone talking. We of Alcoholics not the poggle damn women. Circle triangle on the door. Oh, they're breaking traditions. So I call my sponsor, I'm raving. You know what they're doing in Magnolia, Arkansas? They're breaking traditions. There's a freaking commercial. Says, are you sober? I says, oh yeah. He says, that worked. Shut up. That has been how my sobriety been. You know, I stayed sober. I worked the steps. Now comes the happily ever after part, the AA stories. Yeah. You know what I'm talking about. I got the career I never knew I wanted. I became a licensed counselor. I had a wife and beautiful daughter. The happily ever after part. I was respected in my field. I was dearly loved by my peers. And then a series of events took place, and my wife bled. She took my daughter. All I had left was my job, my career. And that went away too. Then I picked up a box of charts and tore a 4-disc of my back, and things really changed. Emergency surgery, 6 screws, 3 steel rods in a cage, and I couldn't walk and pee on myself a lot. That's when the insanity started to creep back in. I went to meetings, and I coasted. You know what happens when you're coasting? You're going downhill, and you're about to run out of steam and fall on your butt. So I quit going to meetings. I quit sponsoring people. And insanity recurred. January 1st, 2015. I'm in St. Louis. My beloved ex-wife is in town. And I call her. So just come over and let's have a cup of coffee. No, I'm going to see Brian. Resentment. Another year I'm bringing in alone, crippled and broke. So I said the biker version in Serenity Prayer. Epic. I grabbed a fifth of Canadian Mist whiskey. Now, the important thing here is I did not have a desire to drink. I was pissed off. I was pissed off at God. I was pissed off at AA. I was pissed off at my ex-wife. So I spun that cap and I chucked it. And I ain't filled with damn thing. But emptiness, bitterness, and loneliness like I'd never knew before. Now the next day when I grabbed that fifth of vodka, I felt it. And I spent the next few years crawling deeper into the body of that bottle of vodka, pissing off and alienating people I've known for 30-plus years that the only crime they committed was they gave a damn about me. Till I found myself in a bed-bug-infested travel trailer in Palestine, Texas, where it all started. I'm listening to my alcoholic roommate argue with his meth-head girlfriend. And that still small voice had been whispering a bit louder as of late. You know, this is not what you're supposed to be doing. Shut up. Pour Bill Moore a vodka on and get quiet. I don't know what happened. But that night, I just couldn't take it anymore. I got on my knees and I said, God, I need some help. I can't do this anymore. I need to go back to AA, but I don't know how. I had an awful lot of ego tied up in that sobriety days. I need your help to go back. My phone rang immediately. It was AA. Couple of friends of mine, people I'd sponsored, were at the Tyler anniversary. And they said, you know, someone is missing. So they call me. Do you need a ride?
Yeah, I did.
The next day, they drove down, picked me up. I walked into Harvey Hall. It was me at least, surrounded by people I have not seen in years who loved me. My feet has not touched the ground since. They stuck me in a hotel room. You're not going back to Palestine. Somewhere amongst the fog, there were two people. My friend Shelley there. My friend Ed. He said, yeah, you gotta go up there and get a desire kit.
No, I have to,
yeah. Shelley gave me a desire kit. And I was staying there, kind of zoning out, and I turn around, and in the archway, there's this beautiful red-haired goddess, my friend Pooh. She came up and gave me a hug, and she said, Harry, have you ever thought about the Oxford Help? I used to teach about that place. Yeah, I think so. Sunday evening, I'll be dropped off on their doorstep. Didn't know it. They don't do in-person interviews. They did that night. They voted me in. The man I talked to, a guy named Micah. They got me in the house. Me, Gilman nursed me back to health. They got me home. They gave me honey. And they've reminded me who I am. Now, I'm not feeling good one day. My body hurts nowadays. I was in my head, you know, the 90 days ick, you know, where you're still up and down. I'm not getting out of bed today. Not praying, I ain't going to me. Someone rings a freaking doorbell. I gotta get up. Open the door and there's this fresh-faced guy standing there. This 20-something-year-old guy, maybe 30. It's hard to tell nowadays. I'm old. Says his name's Chris, and he opened up that particular Oxford house. And if you don't know what an Oxford house is, it's a sober living house. Then it's founded in 1975 by a couple alcohol drug addict criminals. Yeah, pretty cool deal. So this guy is standing there and he's telling me, yeah, I opened up this house, man. And me and my dog, and he's talking about pain. Well, yeah, it's still here. Come in, you know. He's looking at the pain, telling me about the guy that did it. And how he died from a heroin overdose. And he stops and he looks at me and says, you used to be a counselor, didn't you? Yeah. I said, yeah. I sat in your groups. It was you who taught family education and explained addiction to my parents to where they could understand it. You're the one that made the difference to them and to me. And he looked at me and said, do you see that? Yeah. Yeah, I see that. That, you know, I said something in a group when I was a counselor, when I was sober, and lo and behold, you opened up a house that gave me a place to call home. When I needed it. Again, circle recovery. Again, God doing for me what I could not, and sometimes repeats doing for myself.
I carry his book.
And one of the things in this book is listed names. and pictures in there. But these names are important to me. Modena Richardson, Stanley Cates, Stockers, J.D. Miller, Frank King, Foster, Don Fenton, Gene Burney, Skip Simonson, Mike Dale, Dick Blackwood. He's one that told me, think does not apply to you, Harry. I'll let you know. He's been dead by 20-some-odd years now. I don't think he's going to tell me, so he still does not apply. Truman, Charlie P., David Knoll. These are the people that kept the message of Alcoholics Anonymous alive, so when I walked in the door in 86, I had a place to come to. Those are the names of the people that taught me how to not take a drink for one 24-hour period. These are the people that taught me how to be a human being, a responsible, productive member of society. And all that they ever asked me was that I pass on what they passed on to me. So that's what I try to do. Because my life worked a heck of a lot better when I do. I was left to my own device. I'm an idiot. I get brilliant ideas like, let's stop going to meetings. Let's quit praying. Let's see what Canadian mist tastes like 28 years later. I do not regret changing my sobriety date. It took that to get me to where I am today. It was worth it. Because where I am today, it's in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous surrounded by people who love me, sometimes in spite of me. And more importantly, I have a relationship with my higher power that I never had before. And today, my skin fits better than it ever has. And there's a 23-year-old girl in St. Louis, Missouri, that told me that she was proud of me, that she loves me. That is a gift that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. Thank y'all.
When I first moved back to Tyler after treatment, Eric was my grand sponsor, and I was delivering pizzas. And every time I went to a door and knocked on the door over by UT Tyler, they'd open the door and go, hey man, you want to hit this jack? We don't have any money for a tip, but we can get you drunk. And I was like, no thanks. And so I didn't get any money, right? So I go to another door and they'd be like, you want to smoke weed with us? We got some weed. And I called my sponsor and he didn't answer. You know, I had a phone, it was like a Go phone. What was it? Anyway, I had a phone you had to pay to make calls, right? So it was a big deal every time I made a call. So finally I called Eric and I said, Eric, I keep offering me alcohol and drugs when I'm delivering pizzas. And he goes, oh, okay. I can't do the voice. He goes, just next time you just ask him, do you know Jesus? And it worked. They just shut the door. We're like, you don't want your change? Boom, you know. Eric, what a great story. You're an inspiration, man. I wouldn't be here today without you, for sure. Yeah, I would have smoked weed with the college kids.